Let's look at the big picture, which is this is the most important moment for the Republican Party since the censure of Joe McCarthy and the impeachment and resignation of Richard Nixon, in which Republicans became great heroes and patriots. Now we're looking at Midnight Mitch and the so-called world's greatest deliberative body really embracing a cover-up that is there for all to see. That's what this is about. It's about preventing information from becoming known and seen by the American public.
That was Dustin Hoffman's stunt double, Carl Bernstein, Monday night on CNN, making the... Thank you. Someone needs to bring joy into Nick Gillespie's life, making the 2 for Tuesday case that the Senate impeachment trial, which begins literally the moment we finish recording this very podcast, has a strong oaky notes of both Watergate and the McCarthy hearings. Happy day after Martin Luther King Jr. holiday day, everyone. I am Matt Welch, and welcome to the Reasoned Roundtable, on which I sit beside my trusty colleagues, Nick Gillespie, the aforementioned Clapper, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hey, ya.
Howdy.
Hi.
Happy Tuesday.
So we're going to be offering some darts and laurels. I've never understood what that phrase means, by the way. Maybe Catherine can open up a dictionary for me. About the impeachment process up until this moment. But first, if you listening to this like listening to libertarian podcasts, and I suspect that you might, then you should test drive our friends over at the Lions of Liberty podcasting juggernaut. You can find over at lionsofliberty.com 3 weekly podcasts in one handy feed. The flagship show over the aforementioned name comes on Mondays and features guests such as Ron Paul, Disco Gene Epstein, and our own Nick Gillespie. Wednesday is Electric Liberty Land, which is a comedic look at culture and current events. And then there's Felony Friday, which examines the criminal injustice system. Find them at lionsliberty.com or just skedaddle to your favorite podcasting platform. You'll be glad you did. All right. So today, after 33 months of rumbling and stumbling towards impeachment, beginning with Donald Trump firing FBI Director James Comey under skeevy and disputed circumstances in May 2000, whatever it was, 17, the United States Senate will finally begin its third impeachment trial of a sitting American president. The senators will be considering 2 articles of impeachment that were submitted by the House of Representatives after a weird 7-week delay. This in connection with Trump's skeevy and disputed actions vis-a-vis Ukraine. The charges are abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Much of the drama in the run-up to today surrounds the trial rules as proposed by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. That stuff is going to be hashed out kind of at the same time as our tech wizards are doing their magic with a K with this podcast. So I thought we might take a bigger kind of picture preview by going around the round table, as it were, and attempting to answer a perhaps difficult question, which is this: who, during all of this process to date, in your estimation, my colleagues, has covered him, her, itself in particular glory, or at least managed to maintain some honor and integrity and usefulness in a process that is typically marred by hacktasticness? Catherine, you go first.
I'm going to do this thing, which I was maybe not going to do, and just say, like, actually, the founders. Can I be that guy?
I'm sorry,
but honestly, okay, so you gave us this prompt, right? We prepare for this podcast a little bit sometimes. And
what's the secret in your cake? It's sugar.
Yeah, that's my answer. You know what makes cakes good? Fucking sugar. That's right. The founders are what are doing the right thing in this constitutionally.
That's sweet, sweet slavery.
Oh,
right?
Come on. All right. So basically, it's the first 3 minutes of the podcast and everyone is already too much themselves. But, you know, this process has been messy. I do not think there are very many people at all who have covered themselves in glory, except for, of course, our obligatory Justin Amash, who probably the rest of the three of you were going to say. So I am going to go with, like, the process itself, which, even though everyone, including our lead quote from the grumpy grand old man, is, you know, everyone is saying, like, oh, it's messy and it's political and it's bad. But this is how impeachments are so far. no actual coup, despite the president's tweets. And that is now my standard for success. The founders did that. Otherwise, think about where all this rage would have gone. Not good places. Thank you, my guys.
Since Suderman was obviously planning to say Justin Amash, I'm going to go to Nick next. Who, Nick Gillespie, has been good in this process?
I was going to say Jason Amash, his fake alter ego of the Michigan congressman.
You're not supposed to tell people that.
Okay. Now, for me, the person who covered themselves with some glory is Judge Napolitano. Judge Andrew Napolitano, the Fox News senior judicial analyst, legal analyst, because he's somebody who believes in the Constitution like Amash. And I don't think we need to pick favorites or anything, but, you know, Napolitano calls it like he sees it. And for a long time, when Bill O'Reilly was still on Fox, Napolitano was the only guy calling, you know, the Republican surveillance state apparatus to court. On O'Reilly, he would, you know, shut down conversations when people would talk about surveillance being a good thing, despite, you know, Napolitano doesn't care who he's talking to. He cares about what he believes in. And I think in coming out and saying that he thinks Trump has committed impeachable offenses, I don't agree with him. I don't agree with Justin Amash. I don't agree with Gene Healy and other people who have written at Reason that we should even be having an impeachment trial. I think the whole process is terrible because it is so overtly political. I have a piece that I just put up at Reason about this. I think this is going to end not in tears and certainly not in the end of Donald Trump. It's just going to make everybody a little bit more bitter and a little bit more clingy to whatever stupid truths they had before they came into this process. But I like Judge Napolitano because he goes against the grain, not to be a jerk and not merely to you know, piss people off. He's not Bob Dylan, you know, at the Newport Folk Festival. He's a committed constitutionalist. And I think we need more of that, including people like him and Amash, even if he's in error in this case.
Catherine, I just want to point out that you set that up by saying everyone's being themselves. And
he was like, Dylan. He's like, good. I'll go real quick with some Bob Dylan.
Suderman, you've had time to frantically come up with someone not named Justin Amash.
Yeah, but I said in the podcast channel that I was going to name Justin Amash, and now I'm going to name Justin Amash, who has been really good on this issue for the whole time. He has been really, like, it's funny. We like him for a reason, and that's that he conducts himself in a way that I think is good and honorable and what we should want in a politician. He is a model of nonpartisan decency, of legal precision and clarity. He doesn't suffer partisan hypocrisy or foolishness. And he does it all in a way that's extremely open and transparent. He has explained his thinking at length and in a way that is relatively clear and easy to understand, even if you're not a lawyer, on Twitter. He's the best political Twitter account, and he, you know, probably is the best case against my constant, oh my gosh, Twitter's the worst, griping, because he uses the form so well. And I think
he uses his powers for good.
Yes, he does. He uses his powers.
He uses the powers that all of us have for good.
The power of Twitter.
Can I ask the uncomfortable question, though? If Amash had come out and said, you know what, there is no ground for impeachment, would you still, I mean, are you guys indulging in
no, because he would have given a good explanation.
Goal directed.
No, that's strong. I think many people are in this impeachment conversation for sure, rationalizing, you know, where they already were. I, of course, do that. Peter, of course, does that. You, of course, do that because we are human beings.
No, not Matt.
Matt doesn't
do
it.
I'm not human.
I'm an algorithm.
I've never been accused of being human.
I genuinely think if Justin Amash was tweeting, listen, here's all the reasons why impeachment is bogus, I would. Honestly, it might change my mind because he's that good, man.
I would.
Matt, do you wish somebody would invoke bogosity as an element of how we should be defining things in the impeachment process?
I just assumed
as a Gen Xer.
Sorry,
I just assumed that was a bogosity.
Like bogusness? Is that?
Yes.
Got it.
Yes, bogusness to a maximum degree.
Tubular.
bogosity.
So to go kind of 4 for 4, or at least 3 for 3 on libertarians, but also kind of to
Beach Boys. To Beach Boys.
I don't think Peter was done, but I'm not sure it matters.
I was going to say Batical, no, but that's it. That's okay, all.
He's done as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Only speaking in Ninja Turtles quotes for the rest of this podcast.
To address what Nick just said, my pick for who has done really well is someone who doesn't agree with Andrew Napolitano necessarily and is somewhere close to but not as far as Justin Amash. And that's our very own Jacob Sullum. His writing on this I have found to be consistently the best of any human being on the planet, precisely because Jacob, who's a very, very meticulous thinker in general and just sort of approaches something by showing his math and starting from trying to figure it out rather than like re-engineering from a conclusion backwards. And he has led me down surprising paths that I didn't expect to go, but I was convinced by his arguments about various things, some of which I'll probably get into in a little bit here. But he's just, it's how you don't have to agree with him, just as Nick doesn't necessarily agree with Judge Napolitano, but you will always learn in the process and you can feel a sense of kind of calm and trust that the person who is walking you through some difficult issues to define here is going about it from just a very honest and an explanatory way in the best sense. So Jacob Sullum, I don't say this enough because, you know, he lives in Dallas or someplace and he's a good beard, he's grumpy, but great colleague, great writer, and he's been particularly good on this and has changed my mind about it. Okay, let's go to the easier part. Who, Catherine Mangue Ward, has not been so great in this process?
You know what I'm about to do, right?
Don't do it. Don't say the founders.
The founders. Oh, no.
Yeah,
they could have been clearer. I mean, they could have just a couple more sentences.
You can't have it both ways.
I sure
ways.
Can, Launcher. Nick, yeah. And
She's
I am having it both ways right now. I mean, I'm not wrong, right? Like, they could have been a little clearer. They could have more carefully structured the process to avoid the meta conversation that we are currently enmeshed in. Some meta conversation good, maximum full-time meta conversation about what it even means to do an impeachment and whether it's a legal proceeding or a political process or whatever. Like, a couple more sentences might have given us some guidance and clarity, and I would have appreciated that. So thanks a lot, founders.
It's awesome. Nick, you already started with some shade thrown there. Is there anyone in particular who seems like they deserve more than most?
You know, I'm going to go with Rudy Giuliani because he, and this is more, you know, it's bigger than the impeachment, as is like all of people's bad behavior related to the impeachment, because, you know, the impeachment is like an intensifier. It is, you know, it doesn't change who people are. It just makes them more who they really, you know, are deep down. And, you know, so for the same reason that Adam Schiff was trying to get Trump out of office, you know, before impeachment was broached, or, you know, from the minute he took office, it's like, oh, he should be impeached. You know, he's just more Adam Schiff than ever. Rudy Giuliani, his decline, the arc in the kind of public imagination is amazing when you think about where Giuliani was 30 years ago to where he is now. And he is covering himself certainly in whatever the opposite of glory is with, you know, the way that he acts and the things that he says now and the company that he keeps. But I think I'll say Giuliani is calls into question everything that people can ever think about people being good and decent over the long haul in a political and media context.
Peter, who is your own private Rudy?
Oh, man.
I don't think any of us is ready to really answer that question.
Maybe it's just Rudy from the movie Rudy about Notre Dame
football.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, I'm not sure I've seen that movie. I was gonna say that Jim Jordan is the person who I want to single out as being especially bad. There's too many people on both sides of the aisle who are worth singling out here. It would be a long list if I tried to name them all, but Jim Jordan is the one who springs to mind first, in part because he has been so prominent in this process and has distinguished himself amongst the pro-Trump hacks as the Trumpiest of pro-Trump hacks. He just doesn't brook any, like, he is impervious to any sort of reasonable, logical, or legal argument if it in any way goes against Trump. And it is, again, it is, he's a notable contrast to someone like Amash, who has been, you know, sort of much more careful and thoughtful in the way he's laid things out, where Jim Jordan has just been a pro-Trump attack dog who has not really bothered to make an honest and fair case that he would accept, given, you know, if it were made, say, against somebody who he didn't like. If it were, like, I guess, or, you know, another way of thinking about it is, if Hillary Clinton were president, he would be making exactly the opposite arguments with exactly the same force.
So Lindsey Graham.
Also that.
So, but is that, I mean, Peter, you alluded to it. Isn't that true of virtually everyone in the conversation?
I did say it was a very long list, and it was just that Jim Jordan and his jacketless shoulders that sprung to mind first. And the fact that Jim Jordan has flung himself into this role with such vigor and enthusiasm. He kind of loves it, and he is everywhere doing this. And that is, I think, notable, and that's the reason why I picked him over all of the others, including on the Democratic side, where there are quite a few people who are making arguments against Trump that they would absolutely reject if they were made against a Democratic president of any name.
I can also testify. I know we're not supposed to tell green room tales out of school, but like, yeah, he loves it. He's real happy.
Yeah.
Peter, you said like the making arguments against what other people have argued, making arguments against what they themselves have argued. Yeah. Yes, Lindsey Graham has done that, but so has Chuck Schumer.
Yep.
So people have been in the Senate for 5,000 years, like just, you know, clip and save all over the place. I am going to.
This is one of the effects. I'll just like it's just worth footnoting this. The Senate has gotten older, and I don't know if this is the oldest Senate on record on average, but we are very close to the oldest Senate on record on average. And that's one of the things that happens is that you like live, you know, you stay in the Senate for 30 or 40 or 60 or 1,000 years.
Isn't there some kind of like you die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become
It's
Lindsey
Batman.
Graham.
It's basically Batman, guys.
Yeah.
Don't feed him. I remember speaking to that Suderman that when John McCain died, I was preparing an obituary, and I just kind of assumed that he would be like the last Vietnam vet still in Congress.
Oh no!
Oh my God!
There's so many of them,
and this took me down the rabbit hole of like,
who will be the last fake Vietnam vet?
Oh, that's
Congress,
a good question.
You know,
Blumy.
Blumenthal. Yeah, they're gonna have to.
But yeah,
drag him out in his fake medals.
The list of like the oldest ever senators is like everyone is active for the most part on it, with the possible exception of Strom Thurmond. But that's only if he truly is dead. And I think, Nick, you and I both know that he's not. I will share a fun fact about Jim Jordan. Not only was he a co-founder with Justin Amash of the House Freedom Caucus, and again, whose founding documents out there are always hilarious to read because it's always about trimming back executive power and possible wrongdoing of presidents and supporting outside investigations into said presidents. That's all part of it. But him and Amash, pretty damn good friends. Pretty super
still?
Close friends. Or I don't know about still, but like as of at least last fall, positive, friendly vibe energy between the two men. Okay, my worst person, it's not really the worst person overall necessarily, but I think guilty of the worst mistake in this process. And I don't just mean like tactical mistake. I mean mistake is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She, I think, and this is me being influenced by the great Jacob Solomon. Jacob, that's it. I'm not going to give you any more compliments for the rest of your life.
That's not true.
Maybe. She made the decision, and House Democrats made the decision of, instead of fighting to try to get people like John Bolton subpoenaed, people who had were in the disputed meetings and accounts and like who could tell us something very important, instead of fighting the longer, slow legal battle to get a determination on whether they could be compelled to testify or not, whatnot, she just went with it. And so now so much of the energy, including right now as we speak, or at least as soon as we're done with this podcast, it's all about, you know, are you going to call this witness? Are you going to have new bits of evidence come in? Or should we do this? Should we not do this? So much flows from that. And it makes the constitutional argument, the argument of, hey, the legislative branch has a role here. We're conducting oversight and we're going to be serious about what is a very, very serious gesture. It's only the third time, you know, you could maybe say fourth if you include Richard Nixon. It was grinding up in that direction. It should be more serious than that. We do not live in a serious moment. I would hope, despite that, that some people would rise above. Nancy Pelosi, in speeding this through and punting this in the name of kind of like getting the calendar revved up fast, screwed it up, I think. And that was a bad mistake.
I think I agree with you. And I think, you know, going back to the Carl Bernstein quote at the beginning of the show, you know, this is one of the big differences between the early 70s and now. And, you know, you did have Richard Nixon ended up leaving office because Barry Goldwater and a bunch of other Republicans and conservatives who Nixon had to respect went to him and said, you know what, you have gone beyond the boundaries of what is decent and acceptable, and you have to go. And that's when Nixon finally, you know, gave up his cobra clutch on the White House. And there aren't people now doing that, but it's also because the stakes ultimately are lower. And what Trump is accused of doing is not as bad. Is it's clearly, you know, coming almost completely out of partisan furor. There is an election on the horizon and things like that. That is why we're not going to see Republicans or Democrats actually stand apart from partisanship, I think, for constitutional principles. And it's probably asking too much for politicians to actually be something other than self-interested, you know, pieces of crap. But we're not going to get it in this moment. And this moment, I don't think in many ways calls for it.
Suderman, I wanted you to address a common critique that I'm seeing on the more pro-Trump right, which is that what we are witnessing in these final days, what with the Lev Parnas interview on Rachel Maddow and we got this new document here, is we're seeing the Brett Kavanaughization round two. Like Democrats haven't learned from their mistakes. They're doing all this last minute, blow it up. Everything must be extended. What is your kind of take of that critique? Does it have merit?
I think it has some merit in the sense that there is a faction within the Democratic Party, both in Washington and in the kind of the base of, you know, the folks who elect and Democratic officials and who are activists, who just want to see stuff done that is satisfying in the moment to get the other side. And that would include not allowing Brett Kavanaugh to be a Supreme Court justice or making his life rather difficult in the process leading up to that. That would include impeaching the president. And there certainly has been a faction of the Democratic Party that wanted to impeach him pretty much from day one, certainly from the first couple of months of him taking office. At the same time, that faction is not the majority of the Democratic Party. And Nancy Pelosi, for all of her mistakes here in the way that she has conducted impeachment, and I agree with you, Matt, she has made quite a few mistakes. She resisted impeachment for a long time because she thought that it was, at minimum, politically unwise and that Democrats would be smart not to run against Trump and Trump being a bad dude, but instead to run on basic issues like healthcare and education and the stuff that they won on in 2018, the issues that people actually care about. And so Pelosi felt like she was kind of forced into this. And the reason she made these mistakes, which again, total tactical errors, unusual for her, being a relatively good political tactician. The reason she made these errors is that she felt like the way to appease this faction at this time was to just move through the process, get it done. We're going to have to impeach this guy. We don't, you know, at this point, I feel like, you know, in some ways, House speakers are captive as much as they are leaders, right? That like if their caucus wants to do something, ultimately a speaker of the House kind of has to do it to some extent, right? There's a push and a pull effect there. And so, you know, people who are making this argument that you bring up, that this is just a kind of mean-spirited, nefarious, you know, let's just get Trump by any means necessary. Sure, there's some of that here. But there's also, on top of it, I think there are some real and legitimate concerns laid out best by folks like Napolitano and like Amash about how Trump has conducted himself in the office of the presidency, and that the impeachment process has not done a great job of elucidating exactly how and what happened. But it has given us more information. It has shown, I think, that Trump in some ways what we already knew, but it has shown us in a specific instance that Trump probably abused his power, that Trump is an erratic and not an thinker and an actor, and that Trump is not somebody who thinks constitutionally. And maybe more than anything else, this is the thing that has come out to me out of this impeachment process, is that Trump is a president who doesn't give one whit about the Constitution. It's not like he's sort of thinking, well, I'll ignore it here or there, right? Like, it's not, he's not sort of like deciding, oh, you know, that part, I kind of think it's silly. That part I'm going to ignore or bend, or, you know, that's not my presidential prerogative. He just doesn't care about it at all. He barely understands it. And so,
does he deserve to be unseated for that? Because that's what what Congress and, you know, and all of the legal institutions and framework of stuff keeps in check. He doesn't have to think that.
Yeah, I go back.
And it's not clear. It's not clear to me that, like, anything he's done in office, and, you know, this is for the libertarians who are like, oh, we should be impeaching more presidents. We all know it's not going to lead to every president being impeached. It's because Trump is so unpopular right now. It isn't going to be a precedent. It's a one-off, and it's not based on principle or even pragmatics.
Hey, old people, I have a question for you. Is Carl Bernstein right in that quote up front? I mean, obviously he's full of beans with this whole, like, well, back when Republicans were good because they agreed with the Democrats for a minute, like the strange new respect element of it, we can just like toss aside. But like this question of whether this impeachment process has been characterized by a unique lack of actual truth finding, like actual like acquisition of the facts. Is that accurate? Or is it always a bunch of hooey?
I wrote a column for Reason Magazine recently contrasting the opening statements by the leading committee Republican in the House in impeachment. It wasn't an impeachment committee. It was the Watergate committee, but basically the analog to it. And I forget now the name of the Republican in 1973, I believe it was. But like compare that to Devin Nunes. Nunes was just like immediately witch hunt this and the struck page lovers that. He was just aping Donald Trump's language. And, you know, it, like Hunter Biden is the root of all evil. It was crazy.
Catherine just made a face like, I don't know, maybe Hunter Biden is at least like he's like near the roots of evil.
He's like the fertilizer of all evil.
He's planted in the same garden bed as the root of
rain
evil.
He's an
absolute scumbag by anything and every account for sure. But like that's the root of something that's vast and important is another story. But anyways, the Republican in 1973 was very much like, hey, look, this is an opportunity to restore faith in the institution, in our process. We're going to take fact-finding seriously. And so it was a very good bit of speechcraft that's been written about many times over the years in looking at things. There's a huge difference in that approach in the sort of announcement of seriousness. But we also just don't live in the same culture. It's like, Nick and I probably have said on every other podcast by now, but like the difference between the Bad News Bears when it came out and the remake was that the culture back then was a lot cruder, and now we're a lot more cleaned up. Well, it's kind of the reverse in politics. We still, you know, Nick's post of this morning talks about trust in institutions and how that's gone way down since then. Well, it went way down for a reason, because the institutions absolutely failed. They produced one calamity after another in the late 60s and early 70s. Watergate was just a subset of it. In many ways, much more shocking, the revelations of what the FBI and the CIA and other surveillance institutions were doing that came out in the Church Commission report. So we had that sense of institutional sobriety that looks a lot better looking backwards than the kind of clown show that we
fraud.
Have now.
Yeah,
it wasn't a fraud. I think that's too strong and simplistic.
It's a fraud in the same way that people are. Oh, and you know what's his name? Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in you know news or in America, and it's like it's kind of true. I mean, that quote is a fake, and if you dig into you know Joseph Campbell's work on rooting out how that's a fake perpetuated by one Walter Cronkite, but more broadly. The idea that there were facts and there was a consensus and people acted out of principle. I mean, read Lyndon Johnson's, you know, the biographies of Lyndon Johnson to realize that all what they did is they spoke in the name of principle and then acted however they were going to act. I don't want to be like completely nihilistic and cynical about all of
this
stuff.
Yes, you
do. Kind of are. kind of.
No. But I mean, this is to me the problem with impeachment as a process. And I don't really give a shit, you know, if Trump stays in office or not. I'm neither pro nor anti him. But think, I mean, Ed, Matt, you wrote a great piece for Reason about the, you know, the report that came out about Afghanistan war lies. You know, what was that? Like a couple weeks ago, nobody is ever going to talk about that again. And war is far more serious, you know, than what we're talking about in relation to, you know, Ukrainian aid that Trump actually expanded from where Obama had it and then held it up and then coughed it over, you know, et cetera. But like, we're not even talking about the big, massive systemic lies that the Congress is completely complicit in, the federal government is. And that's, to me, the impeachment stuff, it's just one more way of it. It's like, you know, Congress has taken Adderall and they, you know, they want to get their work done, but they're going to find, you know, they're going to start cleaning out the cabinets and they're going to start doing this and that and everything other. While they have a boost of energy, they're going to do everything other than actually do the kind of work they should be doing.
I think,
Nick, and that's what frustrates me about this.
My position is that that can be broadly true what you say, and it can also be broadly true what Catherine suggested, that the Republicans or at least, you know, Congress acted with more seriousness of purpose in 1973 and 74 than they do now. I think both are possible.
I think that's also true of Democrats. I mean, there are times when, you know, politicians actually act out of principle first, not out of partisanship. That's always going to flow into it. And we need to get to that place, and we need to find more examples of people, whether it's in their own electoral self-interest or not, who actually do that and celebrate them. I mean, that's my piece of Reason today, is about how, you know, the loss of trust and confidence in government, which seems to be a great win for libertarianism, actually ends up backfiring us, because there's a persistent or large body of social science work that shows that when people live in low trust societies, they ask the government to do more and more stuff and to regulate more and more stuff. And I think we've seen that in the past 30, 40, 50 years. We need to engender belief that our government is actually capable of doing something and of being honest and of winning our trust.
Speaking of engender.
Wow.
Catherine.
Wow.
Speaking of engender.
Do it.
Sorry. We are going to talk about Hillary Rodham Clinton. Oh, Rodham. Slagging Bernie Sanders here in a hot moment. But first, and I feel like this forthcoming advertisement should be played to the strains of Jim Carroll's People Who Died, as life should be also played like that. Anyway.
Then he died.
Mike, who should be called Mikey for the purposes of that continuity, was blocked from discussing marijuana legalization at his college. Naomi couldn't start an animal rights club. Sorry. Kevin's school wouldn't let him hand out constitutions. All of these students didn't die. But they had their free speech rights violated by their colleges. Thankfully, all of them got help from FIRE. FIRE is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. It's kind of like, and this isn't part of any ad that they approved, but I'm just going to freelance here because that's what you pay for. It's kind of like what the ACL used to be, except better. But for college campuses, it's a nonpartisan, nonprofit legal aid and public advocacy group that defends the speech rights of all students and faculty at American universities and colleges, regardless of politics. You can learn more about FIRE by visiting thefire.org or texting FIRE to 52886. The Constitution kid that I talked about, Kevin, he took his college to court and won, thus vindicating the free speech rights of more than 150,000 students. If you need help like that, text FIRE to 52886 or visit thefire.org. They fight censors in court and win basically every time. And they also help you how to strategize your various defense when people abridge your constitutional rights. Again, text FIRE 52886 or visit thefire.org. You'll be glad you did. All right, Catherine. Hillary Clinton is persisting, nevertheless. the 2016 nominee is back, absolutely pissing into the tent of a suddenly nasty 2020 Democratic primary, saying in a soon-to-be-released documentary about her rival Bernie Sanders, which she won. Like, maybe get over it. But anyways, quote, he was in Congress for years. He had one senator support him. Nobody likes him. Nobody wants to work with him. He got nothing done. He was a career politician. It's all just baloney. And I feel so bad that people got sucked into it, unquote. She also said she's not ready to say whether she would support the guy if he wins the Democratic nomination. Also said that the campaign misogyny coming from Planet Sanders is a, quote, pattern, and that he, quote, very much supports said pattern. And for good measure, HRC also took a swipe at the media, saying that political journalists are, quote, reverting back to stereotypes, and many of those are highly genderized. All of this in wake of, yes, genderize that throat clear. All this comes in the wake of last week's great post-debate non-handshake between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders after their disparate depictions of a private December 2018 conversation. Catherine, you're a lady. Tell me what I'm supposed to think or say about this.
I mean, first of all, I think we all need to rewatch on slow-mo as many times as necessary with the captions on the Warren handshake refusal, because frankly, it was masterful, right? Like, she was on this stage, thousands of cameras, millions of people, whatever, maybe like only tens of thousands of people watching. And the little hand clasp in front of her was just power. It was just like...
Fun fact, that's how I sleep. That's my hand position when I sleep.
That's very alarming.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. That's really, no, troubling. That's really great.
No, but I mean, I actually do think that if you believe that Bernie Sanders is out there saying women can't be president, then that was an appropriate response by Elizabeth Warren. I, for one, do not particularly believe it. I think that there is a pattern both of real sexism in the world and also of people criticizing women and being accused of sexism when what they mean is just a criticism of something substantive about that woman's campaign or policy positions or what have you. In the Sanders case, I actually think the most compelling explanation to me, having not been there, having not been able to like hear the original comments, is a thing in between, where which is this thing that I've actually long hated. When people ask candidates to describe their electoral calculus or the electoral calculus of voters, to speculate about it, and the idea that he might have been like, I don't know, maybe people aren't going to vote for a lady. Hard to say. Like, that doesn't make you a sexist. That makes you a bad pundit. And I'm perfectly willing to be like, Bernie Sanders, bad pundit, and this is the most important part, socialist, a real socialist who wants to be president. Who cares if he's sexist? He's a socialist, you guys. And this is why Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and all these establishment Dems are trying to come out and figure out the right way to squish him. Because what if we have a socialist for president? That would be super bad, way worse than a lady.
Nick, you're a feminist. Reading the New York Times editorial, which I think you share my opinion, last endorsement editorial ever written.
Speaking of post-hoc rationalization, though, you've been hating newspaper editorial endorsements since you were born.
Did you read this whole thing?
Right after editorial cartoons, editorial endorsements.
That's true.
And you know what is fantastic about that attempt, to endorse two people rather than one? It just shows the irrelevance. And, you know, that is a constitution, an institution in decline. When the New York Times can't just say, we want Warren or Klobuchar or whatever, it's over for this, like it is for the Academy Awards, like it is for NATO, like it is for the Olympics, like it is for all of these stupid old 20th century kind of models of whatever. Like, it's just dumb. Why? Let's stop paying attention to them and get on with our lives.
The important thing is that you don't want to be a nihilist.
No, I'm not a nihilist. What I'm saying is, like,
Times, you just take that bait every time.
The New York Times, like, who cares what they think? You know, like, I mean, in terms of endorsing the president, it does really good journalism on occasion. They have really interesting writers doing opinion pieces and things like that. But, you know, who cares? Like, who cares? And you're right, Matt. It's worth from a mental situation to actually read through the quality of thinking and, you know, just ideological and pathological politicization of everything that goes into that stupid statement. Getting back to the main question, I think Hillary Clinton has a legitimate gripe against Bernie Sanders in the sense that he, more than Donald Trump, is the reason she lost. Trump, you know, Trump got the bare minimum a number of votes, or rather, he got the maximum number of votes that a completely unprepared, unqualified candidate was going to get. He shows the upper limit of what the Republicans can kind of muster in an election when they run somebody who is really bad or is really unprepared for office. Her total got sucked down by many, many things. And I don't think people, because Hillary didn't want to address it at first, and she wanted to talk about, you know, James Comey and the FBI and, you know, the WikiLeaks hacking and all of this kind of crap. It's actually Bernie Sanders, because he showed that she does not speak for large parts of the broad kind of left liberal coalition that the Democratic Party thinks. I mean, she's right to be mad at him. I think she's wrong to say that he is a sexist. I think that sexism exists. And I think Elizabeth Warren has a tougher road ahead of her than either Bernie Sanders or basically any of the other male or younger candidates, because there's also an ageism thing that gets masked in the fact that we're going to have, like, you know, a president who, you know, is going to get endorsements from Depends, no matter who wins. But in fact, she's the one who's taken the ageist hit on the chin more than anyone.
My favorite thing about the endorsement was the board member who said on Morning Joe, this is a quote, "An endorsement isn't about supporting a candidate necessarily."
Sure.
The other thing, though, that's actually worth pointing out from the text of the endorsement is that it makes Nick's point about low trust institutions. They actually write, that the events of this past few years have shaken the confidence of even the most committed institutionalists. We're not veering away from the values we espouse, but we are rattled by the weakness of the institutions that we trusted to undergird those values, blah, blah, blah. Both the radical and the realist models warrant serious consideration, basically because they trust the government less to do the things that they expect it to do. They're including an additional endorsement of a much more radical candidate, which goes, like I said, to Nick's point about how low trust in institutions and in government actually causes people to want more of it.
Suderman, stay with you for a bit. This fight between Sanders and Warren helps above all hair sniffer Joe Biden, because they'll stay in the race and claw each other's eyes out. And as long as they're both in it and both getting support, unless Warren sinks like a stone after this, which I don't think is going to happen, but might still, then there's just not enough, you know, of the progressive vote to overcome the unshakable 28% that Joe Biden gets in every single poll. But you have been following and I think just participated in sort of a tech conference. Joe Biden's been saying some crazy ass things about technology recently, like far beyond what even the super censorious and awful Hillary Rodham Clinton has been saying all of her career in the past about technology and what we should do about these damn companies. Joe Biden wants to, like, send nuclear weapons against Section 230. Walk us through some of the ideas that he has about gaming and other things.
Joe Biden thinks that video games are murder simulators in which you learn to kill. He talked about being at a meeting of video game and tech industry leaders in which, you know, and then, like, he was like, well, there's some little creep there who just makes these things that teach you to murder people, that teach you to kill, you know. So he has this really—
That was Christmas. Yeah. It was his right? Grandson playing
Grand Theft Auto. You know, look, I mean, the evidence is— yeah. The correlation between the advent of realistic violent video games and actual violence in society, particularly amongst youth, is that there is a huge drop. And there's no reason to think that video games add to violence. There is some reason, I would say it's a correlation, not a causation, but there is some reason to suspect that violent video games may actually cause our society to be safer and less violent right now. And then in addition to that, he has really taken after Section 230, not just wanting to tweak it in some of the ways that even folks like, say, Senator Josh Hawley or Kamala Harris want to, where they want to adjust the liability shield, adjust the provisions that it, within 230. Joe Biden just wants to sort of get rid of the whole thing and make online speech virtually impossible. Is what would happen if we took Joe Biden at his word and just sort of gave him the power to do whatever it is that he wants. And this is, I think, part of a growing frustration, hatred, opposition, hostility towards big tech in all of its forms, whether that's video games or social media or even Amazon, which I just don't understand the hostility towards Amazon, which just does nothing except sell you the things that you want at lower prices than other places without making you leave the house. It's not bothering anybody.
Aren't they also the cloud server of the surveillance state too? I mean, that's not...
They're the cloud server
that's
of
That's one of the reasons
the whole
people
internet.
Are...
Although, not just the surveillance state, but in probably because of Trump's animosity towards Jeff Bezos, it does appear that the Pentagon declined to give a contract to Amazon for a big thing, basically just because Trump was like, I don't like these guys. They're against me, the Washington Post, blah, blah, blah.
Now we should impeach him for that after we impeach him.
In any case, I did. I participated in an experimental debate podcast that involved policy wonks and comedians last night in New York. It was an interesting experience, and the proposition was we should break up big tech, and in particular Facebook. I was against it, along with my comedian partner Dina Hashem. We lost. I hope we made some good points and put up a good fight, but it was interesting to see just the level of animosity towards big tech in all of its forms, and not just the sense that it was irritating and annoying and that people wanted to be rid of it, that they wanted to be off of it, but that it was government's job to do something about it for them and to take on a power that they had no ability to take on themselves. And so there was a real... one of the things that I came away from was this real sense that people feel powerless in the face of big tech, and they think that it's government's job to wage a war on it for them. And it's really a sense of learned helplessness that I find interesting and fascinating and kind of disappointing. That is animating a bunch of the left, but also the right as well. And we see that with the Holly attacks on Instagram's endless scroll.
I think it is. I think it's telling, or it's important actually to pull it out of partisanship per se when you talk about Washington and this. Trump hates big tech and, you know, is obviously not really going to do anything about it because he's too busy, you know, selling Trump properties in various places. But he would like to break up Amazon. He constantly is attacking Amazon. He hates Facebook. He hates Google. He thinks, you know, the only thing between diamond and silk and superstardom is Facebook's algorithm and shadow banning on Twitter. But all of the Democratic candidates for president also talk about breaking up big tech. This is bigger than politics. And Peter, I think you're right that sense of helplessness in the face of bigness, which I agree with you is wrong because most people don't actually interact with big tech in a way that suggests they're being victimized or taking an advantage of. But they believe that there is a big problem there. And, this is something that is going to be with us regardless of, you know, whether Trump survives impeachment, whether he gets reelected or not. Because if it's an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders, we're going to definitely see an attempt to have antitrust hearings against a wide variety of big tech companies. Those never go well for individual consumers.
There was really a remarkable lack of argument about consumer harm in this debate. Almost no one made the argument that consumers were being harmed because it's very hard to make that argument. Instead, they said things like, you know, Facebook enables Trump's lies, as if politicians lying was invented by Facebook. And if you got rid of Facebook, which breaking it up wouldn't even do, but as if you getting rid of Facebook doesn't get rid of politicians lying. I mean, we got lied into the Iraq War, the Vietnam, Iran-Contra, you know, the whole, like, it's not as if lying was invented by Donald Trump and Mark Zuckerberg in some sort of pact. It's something that has been around for a long time beforehand. And it's sort of odd, but telling that both sides seem to be blaming big tech for their political losses. So Trump doesn't like it because he thinks the Washington Post is against him. And Democrats don't like it because they think Facebook is what enabled Trump to win the election.
Catherine, I want to tap in one last time to your big anti-socialist energy right now, which seems pretty strong. And also picking up on what Peter's just talking about, lying. You get the sense in the Bernie-Elizabeth Warren spat that there's this, okay, Elizabeth Warren has a past of I don't know, not really selling the truth, talking about like where she sent her kids to school. And there's a whole like background about ancestry that sort of crumbled upon contact with reality. But Bernie, he's trustworthy because he's a barky old socialist, but he's believed this stuff forever. And he says the same stuff forever. But is it not true, Catherine, that part of Sanders's kind of authentic and like honest socialism is based on G-D lies? I mean, like, he's walking around accusing Joe Biden of wanting to cut Social Security. He says that every single trade deal has been a race to the bottom. That shite ain't true.
Yeah, I'm not, like, out here to try and get Bernie with the lies brush. I don't know. Like, I think he's got a lot of problems, most notably. He's a socialist. But, like, he just has a totally different worldview than mine, than most Americans. And so he's seeing things through, like, you know, like more than rose colored glasses, like through straight up red glasses, you know. But I think it is part and parcel with like that beautiful Hillary quote. Nobody likes people who are super, super principled. Right. Like, he didn't have any friends in Congress. That's probably true because he's super, super principled. But his principles are bad and will lead us bad places. I don't think the problem is that he's a liar. I think a lot of problems with these other politicians is that they're liars. I think the people who stan Bernie, the Bernie bros, the Bernie babes, whatever they are, they like him. And we've talked about this for the same reason that a lot of people in our camp, broadly defined, liked Ron Paul. And Ron Paul also had, I think you may recall, no friends. He was sad and lonely. And there are lots of people who would be like, you know why? Because he's a libertarian. Oh my God. And there's like total parallel hysteria about your Ron Paul on the other side. I he's a human. So he lies sometimes, but I don't think Bernie's problem is that he lies. I think Bernie's problem is that he sucks.
All right. That was pretty good. So let's go to our end of podcast. What are you consuming? I'm going to use the prerogative to mention something that we could have talked about and even had semi-scheduled, which is I consumed over the weekend a media panic. It was a passive consumption at the beginning because like, oh, OK, so they're doing Charlottesville 2.0 again down in Virginia. That sounds scary. The violent terrorists are coming together. And then you slowly read places, including J.D. Duchilli at Reason and others. And like, oh, my God, no. The people who last year lobbied against gun restrictions on lobby day in a public protest, this year lobbied against gun restriction on lobby day. But the big difference is that Ralph Northam, the interestingly pictorially historied governor of Virginia, declared a state.
Do we know, by the way, did he admit, was he the guy in blackface or the guy in the Klan costume?
I think we don't know.
I think we don't know. That's a real... May you know, no one ever ask know,
that's the
that
grassy knoll of contemporary
about anyone insert, you love.
Insert that gif. Why not both? But he declared a state of emergency. There's this huge media panic of like those like armed insurrectionists, and I felt the dread rise up in me until I started actually reading about it and come to realize he's just absolutely whipped up by the governor, by media. There was talk that there had been some investigations that showed nefarious evildoers out there. And so it's entirely possible that there's intelligence that I haven't consumed that I would be scared about if I did. But the rally went off without anything like all the bad things happening that people were forecasting. And it was really on the 1 year anniversary of Covington. Seriously, people, this is how we're going to do it. Just like classic media bias 101 is disparate treatments of what happens when people gather whose politics and culture we don't share. Holy crap. Was that a really, really bad exercise of all of it? That's what I consumed. Nick, what did you consume?
In the past week, I watched or rewatched Miss Virginia, the movie about Virginia Walden Ford, a school choice pioneer who helped create the DC scholarship program, as a feature film that was released late last year, starring Uzo Aduba, Matthew Modine, and Vanessa Williams. And next week is National School Choice Week, an annual event where literally tens of thousands of events happen across the country. You can go to School Choice Week or Google School Choice Week and find events happening near you. But Miss Virginia, it's a good narrative film, fictional film, about a real life incident, about a woman who helped to integrate Little Rock's segregated schools in the 50s and then was trying to create a way in which one of her children could escape the DC public schools via a scholarship program, and how she overcame various political and ideological problems in order to pull that off. So it's Miss Virginia, directed by Daniel Hanna, starring Matthew Modine, Uzo Aduba, and Vanessa Williams.
Peter Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I read a novel that was not just recommended to me by Catherine Mangu Ward, but actually physically handed to me by Catherine Mangu Ward, which, if you know her, is an unusual thing, because Catherine reads almost all of her, at least her reading for pleasure fiction, on a Kindle or an iPhone, even.
On my phone.
And so
no, it's the right way to read.
And so I love physical books, and I was like, oh, this is so. She gave me a book. Can I say where this book, the origin of this book?
Yeah,
it came from your. The book that you were reading with your book club, which is like, I don't know how to describe the book club. They're like the muses or something in Catherine. Like, what, she's constantly sort of talking about them. I've met them very, very briefly, but they're like this whole other world of Catherine that I like think of every
It's just like me and a bunch of white ladies doing book club things.
Yeah.
That's how we roll.
Anyway, so they read, of course, a book by a young, educated female author, her debut novel that she wrote in the 20s, Sally Rooney's Conversations with Friends. And this is a book and an author who has been, she is a darling of the literary left right now. She describes herself as a Marxist. She's been written up in Jacobin for writing the post-recession literature that we needed, you know. And you know what? She does. She writes about class and class distinctions and differences. And those are important parts of her fiction. She writes about how money changes people, about how needing it changes people, and also how not needing it changes people. But she's also really an excellent, psychologically astute and humane writer who is just a kind of a pleasure to read in the succinct complexity of her sentences, the ways that she actually seems to understand men and women and gender relations. The book revolves around a young woman who ends up in an affair with a somewhat older man. And it's really, it's just a great book that I would highly recommend, along with recommending Catherine Mangu Ward's recommendations.
That's
Don't just read the book. Get someone who recommends good books to you as well as Catherine.
Good sucking up. I like it.
I will add to Rooney's follow-up novel, Normal People.
Extremely
which was
good.
Released in 2018.
I bought it, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because she is obviously become a kind of darling of the left, but particularly in Normal People, it's a class book that is very consistent with a long tradition in 20th century British or Anglo-Irish literature about class differences. It's really good, and it's not a left-wing screed at all. I think it's more an observational.
Yeah, it does what novels,
the ways in which class position intersects with opportunity and life outcomes.
Yeah, it does what novels are good at doing, which is to attempt to describe and explore social situations rather than make a political argument at you. And as a result, it's frankly a better argument, if you want to say, or sort of better way of like getting me like to think about Marxist, socialist, you know, the Jacobin set of ideas in a way that is less, you know, sort of oppositional than a simple sort of op-ed kind of article essay might be.
Catherine, what have you been consuming besides?
That was kind of my recommendation too. I first want to just briefly share with listeners that what I really did this weekend was injure myself bowling. I like seem to have strained my fingers by going bowling. So that's what I actually did.
Why would you put these vulture-like claws?
It was
into
a mistake, Matt. The bowling balls are not made for people with disabilities like mine.
With which hands?
with which hands?
polydactylism.
But what I actually want to say for my what you consuming is I went and saw Knives Out, which was so good, my dudes. It is a classic country house murder mystery in the Agatha Christie style. It's got everybody in it. It's got your Jamie Lee Curtises. It's got your Daniel Craig's. It's got your Chris Evans in like a sweater that has gone viral just because it looks so good in this movie on Chris Evans. It's got Don Johnson. It's just like a total delight. There's like an ersatz Hercule Poirot character that's like, you know, Monsieur, we just need our little gray cells. Only instead he has like this Kentucky Fried Chicken accent.
And it's Daniel Craig. And so it's Daniel even Craig. Better.
It's just like everything about it is good. Unlike Agatha Christie, who I will defend to the death, but unlike Agatha Christie, you actually are given the tools to solve the mystery in a reasonable way, should you be the kind of person who enjoys mysteries like that. Just a good movie. Directed by Rian Johnson.
Ryan. How do you say it? It's actually Ryan.
It's just fucking sure. Ryan. Yeah. Ryan. Ryan Johnson, who is going to do a Star Wars or did a Star Wars
he
or something.
He did The Last Jedi, and yeah. This movie is a response to bad fan complaints about The Last Jedi.
They clearly just all got together at this country house, filmed this thing in 2 weeks before Daniel Craig had to go be James Bond, and it was like A+ results. Strongly recommend. I read a review that said, you walk out of this movie and you just think, why can't every movie be this movie? And though you know the answer to that question, it doesn't stop you from wanting that. And that was my experience. Knives Out.
Wow.
I don't know why, but that made me the whole idea of a you can solve it mystery. I would love to see Encyclopedia Brown, SVU.
Nick, why would you do that to my childhood?
I just want
I don't know. It just seems like, you know, it's the next evolution of that wonderful series by Donald J. Sobel.
I will sign up
can
for
it
any.
Star Ice-T.
Of course.
Any possible.
He could become the new Bugs Meany.
I just want the Great Brain series to finally be committed to film.
Yeah,
that's really the I can't think about Agatha Christie without thinking about her spectacular unexplained disappearance in her young life, which is one of the greatest.
Or the original title of 10 Little Indians.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Well, we all make mistakes.
She's got a lot to answer for.
She does, and as do we, but we're going to answer by stopping this podcast and going and strapping ourselves to the C-SPAN, if they indeed even have cameras to watch the impeachment's trial that's going on now. So thanks for listening. Please subscribe to all of our podcasts over at reason.com/podcasts, including Nick's Reason interview with Nick Gillespie on Wednesday and the Soho Forum debates and such life. Mm. Don't just not ever make that noise again. Not feminist. Okay, thank you. See you next week, next Monday, because it won't be a holiday. Goodbye.
When you were, Peter, talking about how Donald Trump doesn't think about the Constitution, I was trying to pull up the Don Draper, I don't think about you at all. Like, just, it was too slow. I couldn't do it. I'm disappointed in myself.
You got it here in the epilogue.
I did. I could. Yeah, Ian, can you put Don Draper in that vlog for me here?
I don't think about.